This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to the interview Terry recorded recently with Neil Patrick Harris. Harris has written a memoir that describes the surprising twists and turns of his life and career. He grew up in New Mexico and became famous in his teens by starring on the TV series Doogie Howser, M.D., which premiered on ABC in 1989. After years of being unable to escape Doogie in the public mind, he satirized his image in the film Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle, which opened the door to a new Neil Patrick Harris. He's since starred in the hit TV series How I Met Your Mother, which ended its long run on CBS this year. Harris has performed in several productions of Stephen Sondheim musicals, including Company and Assassins. He's hosted the Tony Awards 4 times, and this year won a Tony for his performance in the musical Hedwig and the Angry Inch. Harris currently appears in the film Gone Girl and will host the Oscars in February. Before we hear Terry's interview with Neil Patrick Harris, let's listen to a clip of Harris hosting the Tony Awards in 2011. This opening number was written by comedy writer David Javerbaum and his frequent collaborator Adam Schlesinger from the band Fountains of Wayne.
Good evening. I'm teen heartthrob Neil Patrick Harris. It's an honor to be back hosting the 65th annual Tony Awards, and I'd like to deliver a very important message on behalf of all of us who care so deeply about this community. If you've seen a show, then you already know how magical theater can be. It's a 2-hour live action, barely affordable, unlip-synced version of Glee. So this song goes out to the rest of you, those who've never seen theater before. Because Broadway has never been broader. It's not just for gays anymore. If you feel like someone that this world excludes, it's no longer only for dudes who like dudes. Attention, every breeder, you're invited to the theater. It's not just for gays anymore. The glamour of Broadway is beckoning straights, the people who marry in all 50 states. We're asking every hetero to get to know us better. Oh, it's not just for gays anymore. It's for fine, upstanding Christians who know all the songs from Greece. It's for sober-minded businessmen who yearn for some release. So put down your Playboy and go make a plan to pick up a playbill and feel like a man. There's so much to discover with your different gendered lover. It's not just for gays, the gays and the Jews, and cousins in from out of town you have to amuse, and the sad and bittered malcontents who write the reviews, and also foreign tourists and the groups of senior citizens and well-to-do suburbanites and liberal intellectuals. Though that group is really only Jews and homosexuals. I've lost my train of thought. Oh yes, it's not just for gays anymore.
Neil Patrick Harris, welcome back to Fresh Air. It is such a treat to have you on.
So, thank you, Terry.
Let's start with the big opening production number that we just heard. You write in your book that you actually wanted to keep the lyrics secret while you were rehearsing. And you had DJ Javerbaum, who wrote the lyrics and also used to work on The Daily Show. You had him write a set of dummy lyrics, of kind of fake lyrics, to use while you were rehearsing. Who did you want to keep it secret from? Was it the people who you were afraid would tell you, please don't do that?
No, not really. It was the people that were potentially going to spoil to the media, spoiling it to people who were going to watch the show. We were worried that if the New York Post or the New York Times caught wind of this idea and talked about it, it would create its own conversation, and then we'd probably have been asked not to do it because it would have, you know, come with its own baggage. So we opted to, do it all the rehearsing in secret. All of the dancers had signed confidentiality agreements. We created dummy lyrics for when we went and recorded it in the with the orchestra. And they were very sort of tepid, average rhymes. And probably the guys that were playing the thing thought, this is what we're doing this year for the Tonys?
It wouldn't be the first time there was a lame opening production number
in an award ceremony. It's not just for gays anymore. It was tonight at the Tony Awards. So it was very sort of milquetoast and vanilla and worked out well. We even went so far as I talk about it in the book. There was a moment where they approved everything except for a lyric that involved the word sodomy, where I said,
come in and be inspired. There's no sodomy required.
I'm so glad you watched it. I say at the very end, come in and be inspired. There's no sodomy required. Bum, ba-dum, bum, bum. And then we kept going with the song. Well, they said to me and us, you can't say sodomy. That is against the rules, which was perplexing because it's an actual word in the term and not a bad word and is actually quite non-vulgar. But they said we could say same-sex love instead of sodomy, which, Terry, hearing me sing, come in and be inspired, there's no same-sex love required. Bum ba dum bum bum. Not quite the same effect. So I was bummed, but then I went to the producer right before the show was airing, because it's live, and I said, what would happen if I inadvertently, nay, accidentally, happened to slip up from the teleprompter? Would we get fined? Would you have to cut to a really wide shot? Would we get bleeped? What would happen? And he said, probably nothing. Why? And I said, no reason. And we went and did the show, and sure enough, they got a phone call from the people that said they couldn't say it, but the damage had been done. The number was a success, and no one got in trouble. So that's one to grow on.
And everybody won awards.
They won Emmys for that one. We all did. That was a good year.
Well, after hosting the Tonys 4 times, then you won a Tony this year in 2014.
For Hedwig, that's right.
For Hedwig and the Angry Inch. And you were amazing in that. You did it for a few months.
Thank you.
A revival. And this is the story of a German performer who has a botched sex change operation. And your performance is incredibly athletic in it. But before we talk about the athleticism of your physical performance, let's talk about your voice and let's hear it first. So you're not used to singing rock, but this is a very rock-oriented score. So let's hear an example of that. And so here's Neil Patrick Harris in a song from Hedwig. Go!
My sex change operation got botched. My guardian angel fell asleep on the watch. Now all I've got is a Barbie doll crotch. I got an angry inch. 6 inches forward, 5 inches back. I got an angry inch. 6 inches forward, 5 inches back. I got an angry inch. I'm from the land where you still hear the cries. I had to get out, had to sever all ties. I changed my name and assumed the disguise.
That's my guest, Neil Patrick Harris, in the cast recording of the revival of Hedwig. And now he has a new autobiography called Choose Your Own Autobiography. So that kind of singing is really different from the singing we're used to with you, which is, you know, Broadway and parody of Broadway. And although Hedwig is on Broadway, it's a very rock-based score. What did you have to learn about your voice in order to sing like that, and in order to protect your voice, knowing that you'd be singing like that every day of the week with two performances, Saturday and Sunday?
Well, the latter concern really informed the former. I didn't have an understudy in that show because it just seemed weird and not fair. I wanted to challenge myself with doing 20 weeks of 7 shows a week and just do it.
That's crazy.
Maybe
you mentioned that in the book.
Maybe in a masochistic way. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I didn't really, I guess ego-wise, I didn't want some other actor sitting there in the second row during every rehearsal just kind of watching me taking notes. That would have freaked me out. But more so, when you put your name above the title of a show that's essentially a one-person show, people are coming to see you do that part. And so if you sit down and you have a little piece of paper in your playbill that says tonight the role of Hedvig will be played by somebody else, it didn't seem right.
You mentioned in your autobiography that you had a great vocal coach for Hedwig, and there were a lot of really good exercises that you learned to strengthen your voice and to protect
Indeed.
Your voice. Can you show us what some of those are?
Sure. Well, as it turns out, the way I carry my personal body is a little neck strained, neck stressed. And Liz Kaplan, my voice coach, who is phenomenal and super friendly and positive, had me do a lot of tongue stretching. Because as it turns out, the base of the tongue is right at the throat. And so if you're nervous, as I tend to be when I sing, then you get tensed up there. So I would literally have to take a paper towel, wrap it around my tongue, hold it with my thumb and my forefinger, and pull it completely out of my mouth. And that moment, like this, I would have to do vocal warm-ups, which is like, and then she'd play a different chord. The idea behind this is to get your tongue to overstretch so that when you stop pulling on said tongue, it's kind of relaxed and you've essentially done like a muscle stretch. So we did a lot of those things, and I would do a full 20-40 minute vocal warm-up before each show just to, again, it was all precautionary. It was all preventative and preemptive because I wanted to not be having to see Liz because my voice was out. I wanted to see Liz so that my voice didn't go out. And I wanted to go to the physical therapist to work on my feet so that they didn't hurt, not because I was getting stress fractures on my toes.
Yes, you mentioned that when you did cabaret, you got stress fractures in your feet because you were jumping around a lot in combat boots in that role.
Yeah, but that's, and I don't know that I would have done it any differently had I to do it again. Probably would have put some Dr. Scholl's or something in the shoe before I stomped around. But to me, that's what I love about theater, is that when you're watching it and when you're there, it's unique to that night. Even though they're all doing the same thing, there's variables that are only happening then. Sometimes the mic goes out. Sometimes your voice goes out. Sometimes an audience member is, causing a stir. Sometimes phones go off. And that's why you go see the theater.
You came out in 2006, and you write in your memoir that you came out in part because Paris Hilton was trying to out you. He'd even offered money to anyone who could present evidence that you'd slept with a man. What was your reaction when there was this kind of, campaign to out you?
Paris Hilton didn't just decide one day to make me talk about, who I was sleeping with and my sexuality part of the story. There was another blog site that had claimed that my publicist had, when asked if I was gay, had said, and they quote him as saying, I was, quote, not of that persuasion. So that phrase, not of that persuasion, was printed as if that's what my new stance was on my sexuality. I never said that. I don't think he ever said that, but that's what they printed. And unfortunately, in the blogger social media world that we live in now, when something's printed, it becomes a story as if it's fact, and you can fight the facts as all you want, but that's already out there. So then I start getting random phone calls and emails from people that I know wondering why I would say something like that. People that I care about, like my agent who was a gay male and thinking he was just trying to get a grasp on why in the world, after living my life openly, being, dating David, living with him, why in the world I would say something like that. So I had to then do a first wave of apologies privately to people saying, I didn't say that. I'm working on something to say, but I didn't want to respond in defense. I didn't want to say that website is blasphemous and make it seem like I'm ashamed of who I am in some way. So my team all kind of huddled together and hammered out a statement that we thought was appropriate. And that happened right after, yeah, Perez Hilton, who at that time was a bit of a headhunter for celebrities who he wanted to be representative of same-sex sex, was trying to out them. So I just didn't want to, when you said earlier that he asked for people to come forward with stories, that was the time I thought, I want to beat a story. I don't have many sordid stories, but I didn't even want someone to come out with a lie story. And then my statement is suddenly defending myself against a bigger story. So it just seemed like the straight-up thing to do, pardon the pun, to say something that was honest and true, and if anything, theoretically empowering to people who may be in a similar situation. So we came up with that statement, and it turned out well.
So, you know, when you're doing Doogie Howser, and what you're playing, like, a boy genius who's a doctor. did you have any idea then that you were gay?
Oh, wow. Not really. I mean, I had friends that I was, extra interested in hanging out with, but I went through puberty later than most. You know, on that show, I really grew a lot between, I think, the second and the third season. So I was almost turning 18 years old when I really started growing, you know, and turning from a boy into a man. So that was on the late end of the spectrum. So if anything, I yearned to be more sexual. I don't think I was able to really define it of like, I wish that I could make out with that guy and not that girl. I was friends with girls and kind of idolized guys, but I wasn't in a position at that time to know how to actualize that. And being in a small, tiny town in the middle of the mountains of New Mexico, there weren't a lot of examples around me in my real life and even on television at that time of, you know, there weren't a lot of Kurtz in Glee and Ellens and people like that mm-hmm. you could look to as right. options.
So what was it like for you before you felt sexual and you were maybe, you know, not quite sure of what your sexuality was, to be seen as like this teen and maybe preteen heartthrob and have to like pose for teen magazines?
It was the worst. It wasn't the worst. It was just very strange. Because that back then, it was a different time, and there was Teen Beat and Teeny Bopper magazine, and I don't know. They all had strange names like that. Banana Pudding, that wasn't one, but it was something like that. Tutti Frutti, I think one was called Tutti Frutti. And each of these had a montage of handsome, teenage kids. But they were all River Phoenix broody. It was during 90210, so it was... It was all the cool kids, and they all looked so studly, and it was New Kids on the Block, and they had sideburns, you know? And so here was me, named Doogie, with kind of frizzy, curly hair, big ears, an Adam's apple, acne, and a bolo tie, holding a basketball with a lime green backdrop, and I'm wearing a T-shirt that's four sizes too big, trying to brood and look sultry for the camera. It was, I felt like I was definitely not in the right movie while that was going on. But thankfully it wasn't, Doogie was busy working. I say that as the character, and I say that as the chapter, because I had to do 3 hours a day. I was on set all the time. I was doing promotion for the show. There was a lot to memorize for the next day of medical jargon, of history chapters that I had to study about ambulances, and there was a lot of work to do. So rather than spend my time focused on photo shoots and going to malls and shaking hands, I was really working on the show. And then when I was done for the last few months of the year, I would go back to my hometown. Then we moved to Albuquerque, and I would get to spend time as a normal, regular person for a few months there.
I hope you don't mind I bring this up. You mention it in the book that you lost your virginity, your heterosexual virginity, to a girl whose girlfriend dared her to sleep with Doogie. How did you find out that she was sleeping with you on a dare?
All of my friends in high school seemed so cool, and they all were so manly, and all of their exploits were like in the back of a car on a mesa with a with a keg of beer, and, you know, she was the girl everyone wanted, but he got her, and it was great. And I was just not that kid. I just didn't have any game. I didn't even know how to do it, and I wasn't really into it, but it seemed like what everyone was doing. So we were at a party at someone's house, and some girl was there from college, New Mexico State University, with a friend, and told my group of friends that she wanted to have sex with me because I was on a TV show. And so my friends were like, this is the time! It's perfect! And it seemed perfect at the time. So I said, you got it. And then it happened, and it was my first time, so it was very warm and exciting. And then she was done. She didn't want to date me or anything. We were at a party, so I was sort of shell-shocked by it all, and she sort of, I don't even think she thanked me. It was, and I was, okay, well, where's my pants? And then she was gone. It was very unceremonious. I was the man. It was awesome.
So was it an affirmation to you, like, I am a straight man?
No, I'd heard so many stories of people's first times not being, what they're supposed to be. There's so much built up to it.
Right.
I was glad I could just accomplish the act, that I didn't, have to stop and, reboot. It just wasn't, there was an emotional element missing for sure. And I've slept with, more than her in my life. And it was just never felt like, it always felt like I was kind of maybe covering up for something or there was something missing. And then I finally had, a fun encounter with a guy. And weirdly, I was terrified that would happen and it would be fireworks and all would be right in the world. And I would know for certain that this was who I was supposed to be with and now what was going to happen. And it kind of wasn't that way either, because I think who you're intimate with is much more about the connection between two people. So it's not just like when I kissed a guy, I suddenly was, gay and knew it all. That was the end of it all. It was fun, but it was a baby step towards a much, much longer journey of kind of self-awareness and self-acceptance.
Neil Patrick Harris speaking with Terry Gross. Neil Patrick Harris's new memoir is called Choose Your Own Autobiography. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry Gross online at freshair.npr.org. The musician Prince has been busy lately. He re-signed with Warner Brothers Records and has released two new albums simultaneously. Art Official Age appears under his own name, and Plectrum Electrum is the debut record of a Prince backup band called Third Eye Girl, but with Prince's vocals, guitar, and production style throughout. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews both albums.
Hello, how are you? You're looking so fine. No, it's true. Remember the time we first met? You think that was good? You ain't seen nothing yet.
Prince bids us greeting upon his return to the record label that launched him, Warner Brothers. With his basket so full of songs, he had to release them in two albums. Never unmindful of pop history, Prince is making like 70s-era George Clinton, when the latter used Parliament and Funkadelic, two acts with mostly the same musicians, to express different sides of his ceaseless creativity. And so where Plectrum Electrum is largely a guitar rave-up album, Art Official Age features some fine, funky ballads and sexy ditties like this one, Breakfast Can Wait.
Hey, baby, where you going? Now please don't rush off so soon. And if you leave me like this, what am I going to do?
Suddenly my eyes are open. best, but I just wanted to tell you, I think you're great. I know you're late, but I need another taste. Breakfast can wait.
Breakfast Can Wait would not have been out of place on 1980's Dirty Mind, yet it's also a very contemporary sound here, proof once again that Prince's music can seem as timeless in its way as, say, Bob Dylan's or James Brown's. There are, however, times on both of these albums when Prince's musicianship outstrips his imagination as a songwriter. There's a recurring science fiction theme sprinkled over Artificial Age that gets stale quickly. And the positive girl power messages pushed in Plectrum Electrum suggest that Prince isn't quite sure of what tone to take in writing for female voices. But his mastery of the slow jam ballad remains undiminished.
You said I was what you wanted, liar. You never wanted me that way. I was just something you flaunted, higher, fire. You never had a plan to stay. If you don't like it round here, find another love. Anyone can see it so clear. Find another love.
If Plectrum Electrum was meant to launch Third Eye Girl as its own act, it doesn't quite. Guitarist Donna Grantis, bassist Ida Nielsen, and drummer Hannah Ford Welton provide a solid rhythm section and some rather wan lead vocals. The album, which Warner Brothers says was recorded live and in analog, certainly has its pleasures. Check out the slamming punk beat of Mars, with its pointed lyric about a McDonald's employee giving away food because he can't bear to, quote, watch another black child go to school with nothing to eat.
Lost my job at Mickey D's, from giving away too much food for free. But I couldn't watch another black child go to school with nothing to eat.
There are two versions of the first single from this project, Funk and Roll, one on each album, with different arrangements and instrumentation. This one, from Artificial Age, is the more interesting and fun, I think, grandly overstated and stuffed with witty sound effects.
Finally, beloved, we meet at last. Middle of the hill, never mind the past. Only way to get you where you never been. Let's party like you ain't gon' party again. Let's funk. Let's roll. Get it turned up, get it out of control. Get into the rhythm, it's good for the soul. Let's funk.
Now in his 50s, Prince is by all accounts putting on expansive live shows that rival anything he was doing as a 20th century hitmaker. And coming out of a guitar rave up on one song here, Prince stops singing to advise his audience, quote, "Don't worry about what the crowd does. Just worry about being good at what you love. Don't make this complicated." He then plays a quite complicated guitar solo. Contradictory? Maybe, maybe not. Prince never said making art was easy.
Ken Tucker reviewed two new albums from Prince, Plectrum Electrum and Artificial Age. Coming up, we'll hear Terry's interview with Justin Simeon, who wrote and directed the new film, Dear White People. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross.
Dear White People, the minimum requirement of black friends needed to not seem racist has just been raised to two. Sorry, but your weed man, Tyrone, does not count.
The new film, Dear White People, is a satire about race relations and racial identity, set on a fictional Ivy League campus. We're going to hear Terry's interview with the writer and director of that film, Justin Simeon. The character we just heard, Sam, Samantha White, is the host of a campus radio show called Dear White People. She's also the newly elected head of the Black Students' Residence Hall. In this scene, she's in the hall's dining room, talking with the former head of the residence and some other Black students about whether they still face a lot of racism. Later in their conversation, you'll hear them interrupted by a white student who's the editor of the campus humor magazine.
I really don't see the issue. Never had one, never ran into any lynch mobs.
Lynch mob's still here, just rebranded itself.
As what, pray tell?
The Republican Party.
You want to know how the world sees you? You go to a young Republicans meeting and bring up welfare.
Or immigration.
Well, I get your rights.
Bull. You have something to add?
Me? Yeah, I do. Look, your biggest athletes, right? Movie stars. Hell, guys, my president is Black. Okay, sometimes I think the hardest thing to be in the American workforce right now is an educated white guy.
You're not serious.
Hey, look, you guys still got affirmative action. That's all I'm saying.
I'm sorry. What exactly are you doing here?
All right, check this out. You ready? Obama, right? Leader of the free world. He gets into Harvard based on you. Too late. Affirmative action. You know who's not president right now? No? The guy who didn't get in.
On behalf of all the colored folks in the room, let me apologize to all the better qualified white students whose place we're taking up.
No, it's fine. We're okay.
I'm sorry, did you get lost? Bichet's that way.
Oh, I know where it is. I'm actually supposed to eat there. Yeah, it's just this is the only dining hall that you can actually get yourself some chicken and waffles. Look, you're dear white people, right? It's funny. It's funny stuff. It really is. How have we not staffed you yet?
Oh, me? Oh, what? On Pastiche, your uninspired humor magazine?
It's actually much more than just a magazine, sweetheart. SNL staff is basically half Lampoon, half Pastiche. Same goes for the network comedies.
And what gives you Clubhouse kids the right to come to our dining hall? You don't live here.
Sam, what are you doing?
So you can't eat here.
Chill, Sam. Damn, all right? Let the man eat.
Got this.
Got this. Look, who are you to throw me out?
Oh. Well, I think I'm head of this house. And I'm doing things my way.
Dear White People is Justin Simeon's first film. He tested some of the ideas and jokes by opening a Twitter account called Dear White People and tweeting the kinds of funny, intentionally provocative statements Sam makes on her radio show. To help get the film produced, he first made a trailer and used it to attract funders. The trailer went viral, which helped him raise a lot of money through crowdsourcing. When the film premiered this year at the Sundance Film Festival, it won a special jury award for breakthrough talent.
Justin Simeon, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. So good to be here.
Before you had your movie, you were doing Dear White People tweets. So give us a sampling of what some of those tweets were.
Oh, God. Let me see. I think the first one was... Dear White People, the single lady's dance is dead. Leave it alone, or something to that effect. I just remembered sort of being overwhelmed by the ways in which that particular facet of Black culture had been appropriated and sort of run into the ground. They were both critical and sort of, you know, complimentary. But they were all sort of intended to kind of quietly refine the voice of Sam White. You know, I had been working on the screenplay for some years at that point and wanted a way to sort of test out her very specific brand of humor on the world at large and see how it would react. And, you know, both positive and negative, the sort of feedback, the sort of instant feedback you get from Twitter really went right into the screenplay and how I sort of developed her and sort of thought about what would happen to her in that world.
Did you have any white friends who were offended by the Dear White People tweets?
I didn't. At least they never said it to me. You know, I was working in publicity at the time, and I'm very used to being a Black face in a white place. And, you know, none of my beautiful, wonderful, encouraging white friends ever had a problem with any of it.
Your movie set in an Ivy League college. Tell us about the college you went to.
I went to a lovely school called Chapman University, a private school in Orange County, California, with an excellent film program, and for whatever reason, a desire to give me money to go there, which was a huge factor in my choosing it. But also, it was close to L.A., and, you know, I was from Houston, Texas. I recognized very early on that I wanted to be in film, and it ended up being a very interesting experience. Because the education was excellent, but I also had a huge cultural shock coming from Houston, Texas, from a very diverse sort of group of friends to, you know, part of the country that is not terribly diverse.
Well, what was the difference between the racial makeup of the community you were from and the high school you went to compared to, you know, the racial makeup of the college that you went to?
Sure. Well, I lived in a mostly black, and I would say all black neighborhood in Houston, Texas. But I was a part of the magnet program, so I was shipped to, you know, different schools sort of outside of my district. So I found myself constantly as a kid kind of between all black worlds and mostly white worlds. And my middle school was probably mostly Latino. And by the time I got to high school, I went to the high school for the Performing and Visual Arts in Houston, HSPVA. And it was like a Benetton ad. I mean, there were just people of every possible race, sexual orientation, gender identity. You know, it was a bunch of artists, art kids. And so to go from there to, you know, certainly the films, I would say the film program, which is the part of my college that I had the most interaction with, was fairly diverse and pulled kids from all over the country. There was a, you know, group of kids at the school who really obviously had not had a lot of time with black people in real life. You know, I tell the story of my suite mate sort of insisting that he was blacker than me, as a blonde, blue-eyed kid, insisting that he was blacker than me because he could crip walk and I couldn't and had no interest in doing such things. You know, I remember the sort of crestfallen look on some of my friends' faces when they realized that I, despite being tall and black, had absolutely no sports abilities whatsoever. You know, and just that sort of thing, people sort of being very surprised by me both being black and sort of nothing like the black people they were used to on TV. I could try as hard as I could. I could never sort of fit whatever the image of, you know, the popular culture image of a black man was. And, you know, being gay didn't really help with that either.
So there's a character named Sam, a young woman named Sam, who is like the more militant character in the movie. She's the one who insists that the residence hall should remain African-American and not diversify. She is the one who does the Dear White People broadcasts. And she's just angry, and a lot of that anger is directed at white people. She's also, we learn later, biracial. And I'm wondering if you put that in because you feel like you've seen things that felt to you compensatory for having one white parent and one African-American parent, and people who you felt were like overstating their blackness as compensation for that, or, you know, out of some kind of insecurity about, like, well, what am I?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, I don't think that that's necessarily true for every biracial person, but I think that I've certainly seen and just heard many stories of people who are biracial who do feel like culturally there's a choice to make. Like there's one or the other. And you have to sort of draw a very, you know, hard line in the sand of who you are because otherwise people will sort of make that decision for you. They will sort of place you in a box before you even have any say in the matter. And sort of as a, and frankly, that is really, it speaks to the heart of what I understand the black experience to be, is that when you walk into a room, you know, life has taught us that people are going to have untrue presumptions about you. And so, you know, as a way to sort of defend against that, you kind of have to there's this pressure as a black person, biracial or not, to sort of make declarative statements about what kind of person you are. And, you know, just my mother is Creole. So she, you know, is very light skinned, African-American woman and, you know, relayed many stories to me, growing up of just really having, you know, because it didn't matter that she was light skinned, like she was black in the eyes of white people growing up in Southern Louisiana. And, you know, so for her, like she made a very specific and clear choice that she was going to identify very specifically as an African-American woman and make that known to people. And, You know, for me, yeah, I think it is a pressure that society sort of places on us, you know. As a kid with a light-skinned mother, it wasn't the same exact issue, but I remember sort of having to sort of explain that to people, you know, kind of growing up. And it is an added pressure, I think, of being a black person, period, whether you're biracial or not. And I think for Sam, you know, I think she's really, what she's about to me is someone who is, I think, being very genuine and authentic to her voice, but only half of it. And, you know, because because putting them together in the same box seems so impossible, you know, in the culture with which she's in. And that is a very unique pressure to people of color. And, you know, to me, like, you really can't talk about the black experience unless you bring up that particular kind of pressure.
Are you light-skinned, and has that been an issue in your life?
No, I'm obviously black, I think. Although there was some very hilarious debate on Twitter recently that I had to squash with a tweet that just said, I am black. I don't know what would I be called? I don't know what my shade is, but I think I'm an obviously black shaded person, if that's a PC term to use.
What was the debate about?
Just someone, for whatever reason, there was just a group of people on Twitter laughing because they thought it's funny that some white people were offended by the title when the director is white. And, you know, I was like, huh? You know, so I just chimed. I just kind of chimed in via Twitter just to clear up any sort of questions about, you know, what I was.
There's a satire magazine on campus in your film that does not come off very well. they're arrogant. They're, you know, they're crude, particularly the leader, and kind of racist, and confusing kind of satire with just being offensive.
Right.
Did you have a bad experience with a humor magazine?
No, I didn't.
What did they do to you?
I know, they ruined my life. No, I just, you know, really, it was that particular aspect of the film isn't really even meant to sort of, like, I don't know, criticize humor magazines in general, and certainly no specific ones, but I did find out here in LA these closed loops of liberal white people that were unintentionally offensive and had no idea, you know, truly that they were being that offensive, because to them it was irony and it was satire. You know, to them it was satire. It was irony. It was just sort of saying, you know, the most shocking possible thing. And I would walk away from experiences with those people feeling like, wow, these are the people who are writing the culture, you know? Just as a black person watching TV, a fan of comedy on television and sketch shows and things like that. And you can always feel when that writer's room had no black people in it, you know, just the way that joke is told or the way that scene was portrayed, the way that the one black character in the program was written, you know, just felt very much like seeing myself through the eyes of people who had no contact with anyone like me. And really, that's what Pastiche is meant to represent in the film.
That's the name of the humor magazine.
Yes, Pastiche.
So much of your film, Dear White People, is about, like, a new form of segregation on campus. It's not official segregation, but, you know, the white students sticking to themselves and the black students sticking to themselves. And I'm wondering if you see an equivalent in the film world, you know, that there's films that are predominantly star African-Americans that have a predominantly African-American audience, and vice versa, films that are about white people and have a predominantly white audience, and that, you know, it's maybe surprisingly unusual to have a really integrated movie audience in a lot of multiplexes or art houses.
Yeah, I think it's strange because that's not really reflective of America at all anymore, or even groups of people in America. You know, it's very rare that I ever have a day where everyone I encounter is black. But, you know, quote unquote black movies, sometimes everyone in the world of the story is a black person, which, you know, I've never been to that neighborhood, but, like, let's do it. We're just all day long, like the postman, the person at the drive-in, you know, everybody in the world is black or white. I've never seen that version of America in real life. But I think specifically recently as Hollywood has gotten more myopic and sort of has to, you know, make very specific choices, based on how they think the audience will respond when sort of putting a movie through the production pipeline. Yeah, it's gotten real crazily bad, I think. I think TV's gotten it right. You know, Shonda Rhimes has figured it out of getting multi, you know, racial casts on television and appealing to everybody. And, you know, it's interesting because I haven't seen that with quote unquote white movies, which, you know, most people just call movies. You know, they don't just appeal to white people. Sort of, you know, it's just sort of taken as a given that a white cast represents everyone. You know, a white person, a white male in a movie is an everyman type character, whereas a black male in a movie is a black character, and it's a black movie, and it's only for black people. But, you know, me and all my black friends go to see everything. And, you know, so I'm kind of like, when making the movie, I never really understood why that wasn't really reflected in the art house, which is the aspect of you know, the cinema that I'm particularly interested in. You know, I love art house movies. I love movies that come from auteur voices that are very specific and have their own point of view. And there's very rarely people of color in those stories. And it's not even necessarily that those stories have to be about the experience of people of color, but I just sort of, yeah, I kind of get tired of going to movies that I think are going to be great and not seeing myself just anywhere in the picture, literally in the picture. It's frustrating because I love those kinds of films. And, you know, I think when I first started writing the film back in 2006, you know, which is for me a particularly bleak time for black movies, there were really only a couple a year at that time. And, you know, I just sort of longed for the days of, you know, School Days and Do the Right Thing and Hollywood Shuffle and Love Jones, where like you'd have a variety of movies out in a year that were just great and they had people of color in them. And, you know, maybe not everyone went to go see them, but large, you know, they drew large crowds. You know, Boys in the Hood was like this huge phenomenon when it came out. And I feel like we don't really have that equivalent today, you know, unless it's a very sort of specific kind of black story. And so I wanted to sort of introduce a film that that sort of spoke to a different aspect of the black experience that wasn't sort of tragic in the past or urban or, you know, fluffy light romantic comedy, but that still had people of color in it.
Justin Simeon wrote and directed the new film Dear White People. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry Gross online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sharrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.B. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.